You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 80. This minute begins with Shaw saying, "David, I want to see it," and ends with David saying, "To lose Dr. Holloway." It is a terrifying concept, and one that is at the heart of the Alien franchise. This unknown creature rapidly growing inside your body. I believe body horror is one of the most effective forms of horror because it taps into universal fears. We are conscious beings, but ones bound to a physical form that can, at any moment, betray us. It is physical matter like anything else. It can be manipulated and mutilated and destroyed. It is an uncomfortable thought to be reminded of this. In the case of Alien, this mostly takes a form of forced impregnation and parasitism, which is scary, but to me what happens to Fifield and Holloway is far worse. At least in Shaw's case, she stands a chance of surviving. The threat is inside of her, but it is a separate entity that can be extracted. In the case of a chest burster, it's more of a ticking time bomb. There's no way to safely extract it, so if you are unfortunate enough to understand your predicament, you just have to live with that sense of impending death. I wonder if the Xenomorph adapted to attempts at extractions over the generations. Here, this prototype is completely defenseless, but presumably over time they encountered species capable of surgery and compensated for that. Either way, Fifield and Holloway still have it worse. They are physically transforming. There's no division between the monster and the man. We think of our identities as these distinct and permanent things, but even that is a result of biological processes, many of which we don't fully understand. Fifield's body still continues to operate long after any trace of his identity has been destroyed. The same would likely have happened to Holloway. With these two characters, we have the opportunity to see similar conditions at different stages of the process. With Holloway, you watch him rapidly change physically while being fully conscious and capable of speaking and conveying his experience. He dies before he loses himself, and we are left wondering what would have happened had he continued to live. In a way, Fifield answers that question, and it's not pretty. I'm not a huge fan of the mutated Fifield design, but the implications of his condition are disturbing. It's worse than being a zombie. A zombie dies, and there's this distinct line between your existence and its existence. The basic motor functions and instincts take over. It's another being, another consciousness, if it can be rightly called that. In the case of the mutagen, it's changing you in ways you can't predict or comprehend. Your identity dies, but it's this gradual decay. At what point are you no longer you? The true horror of Shaw's situation is based on female anxieties about their own bodies, whereas Kane's demise was more suggestive of male anxieties about rape and penetration. The facehugger essentially shoves a phallus down his throat, and really the facehugger is both vaginal and phallic, as only Giger is capable of designing. Many women have conflicting feelings about pregnancy. Some are disturbed by the very idea that their bodies could start this process without their knowledge or consent. Their bodies are just these baby factories, whether they like it or not. Even women who want children have a lot of anxieties about various aspects of pregnancy. The body changes, the pain of labor, and so on. And some people treat pregnant women differently, so there is almost a sense of identity loss, at least in terms of how others perceive them during this period of their life. And for Shaw specifically, this is almost Faustian in its sadism. This is a woman who seems to desperately want children, but she's infertile. Well, congratulations, lady, it's a baby squid. Even more ironic is that technically she was impregnated by Holloway. At every step, this is a perversion of a natural process, one that Shaw would otherwise have welcomed.
Our best option...
I want it out.
...put you back into cryostasis until we return to Earth.
Please, get it out of...
Who says stasis like that? Anyway, why does Shaw resist this plan? It's only natural to panic, but at this point she has no reason not to trust David. She would have no reason to suspect a thing. In hindsight, it's good that she doesn't surrender willingly. Or maybe it's a bad thing, or maybe it makes no difference at all. It really depends on how you look at this situation. If she goes into cryo, she's spared the horrendous abortion scene. But she would also die when Yannick, Ravel, and Chance collide the Prometheus with the Juggernaut. Unless she was stored in Vicker's pod. Either way, she's trapped there forever because David would just be ahead lying there until he powered down. Alien Covenant never happens, the universe is a moderately happier place. So yes, this is clearly one of those scenes that has to happen in order to move the plot along. And it's not totally irrational. Who wouldn't be freaked out in this situation? We can never know her thoughts, but I can imagine she wasn't keen on the idea of this thing being inside of her for years on end, even if it would be in suspended animation. Shaw and David are an odd ship. I say that because this scene in particular of David carrying Shaw and attending to her seems to be a point of fixation for shippers, or fans of this relationship. I mean, each to their own, but I do find it fascinating to see what people respond to about this relationship. From observing the fandom, I think part of it is imagining an alternate scenario, or seeing what they want to see. This scene is emblematic of that. David attends to Shaw, carries her in his arms. Some fans respond to that in a positive way, or it's merely fuel for their imagination, I can't rightly say. I know there was even a desire to see their relationship develop further in Alien Covenant, and that certainly was the case in the original script for The Crossing, which is quite romantic in nature. I do find that dynamic interesting, but in the same way I find Evie and V compelling in V for Vendetta. It's totally wrong, abusive, and the power balance is uneven. But there's something exciting about watching dangerous relationships. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like cute, wholesome couples like Joyce and Bob in Stranger Things Season 2, but they're... Well, it's the same thing as other kinds of dangerous or dark fantasies. It's just kind of fun and outside of your real-world experience. Whenever something like Twilight or 50 Shades of Grey becomes popular, there's a lot of pearl-clutching going on. It's the equivalent of violence in video games. No amount of exposure to these things is going to motivate someone to engage in that stuff in real life unless they were already that way inclined. Like, I know a lot of couples who are into Joker and Harley and kind of, I don't know, emulate them, base their relationship on them, but again, it appears to me that they know it's a fantasy. They're not taking it seriously. I wouldn't say I ship David and Shaw, but I certainly find their relationship fascinating in the same way I do with Clarice Starling or Will Graham and Hannibal. It is fascinating to watch children and teenagers enter fandom and how they respond to these stories. There's a plethora of fanfics in which David really is a good guy if you just took the time to get to know him. It does seem silly or naive, but I think it's great that kids are exploring these concepts. We've got to start somewhere. David is much like Frankenstein's monster in that he becomes a monster as a product of how the world has treated him. We are, on some level, meant to empathize with his pain and discontent. This does not, however, excuse his actions, but a lot of readers and viewers are too empathetic that they go, well, this character was so horribly treated, I really feel for them. Yeah, but they're still a monster. Just because you know why someone does something doesn't justify what they're doing. Loki is a similar and more popular example. Girls love a bad boy. In the case of Loki, he has arguably caused far more harm on a larger scale than David, especially Prometheus David, but he gets away with anything. Loki is kind of the canonical example of what a lot of fangirls do with villains in their stories. Loki's past crimes are kind of just swept under the rug or played off comedically. It's funny to try to imagine David getting the same treatment. Oh, that wacky genocidal robot, what will he do next? But in David's case, it is a clear trajectory downwards. In Prometheus, he's a bit of a passive-aggressive jerk. He's not the prime antagonist, and it's really only in this minute that he shows his hand and we see a glimpse into his true nature.
Must feel like your god abandoned you.
What?
To lose Dr. Holloway. After your father died under such similar circumstances.
That's some real supervillain dialogue there. It's a condescending sort of pity. In a sense, he does relate, but there's no genuine empathy there. And that was basically the fundamental concept they wrote David around. A crew of humans are on a mission to meet their creators. Meanwhile, they are served by an android who has always known his creators, and it is terribly disappointing. Little details I noticed in the scene. Shaw has bruising on her knee, probably from when she collapsed as Charlie died. The other detail is a robotic arm in the background, seemingly organizing some kind of samples. They've gone to the effort to make this puppet in the background just to add a little bit more to this world. The samples of some kind of yellow liquid, I don't want to know. Shaw gets up and she's tapping at the console on the medical bed trying to access the ultrasound. David turns the screen away from her view, but there's an identical monitor with the same readouts on the other side of the bed. Great plan, David. He then sedates Shaw with what looks like a hyperspray from Star Trek, but it seems like it is actually a needle, so I'm not sure how this invention is in any way superior to a normal syringe. Speaking of, apparently there have been various attempts at making real-life hypersprays over the years. MIT created a jet injector. The new jet injection method delivers a drug through the skin at speeds of up to 340 meters per second and in under a millisecond, as can how deep it is injected. And as far as the patient is concerned, they shouldn't feel anything other than the tip of the injector against their skin. That's because the jet is as thin as a mosquito's proboscis. No needle and no pain will certainly take the stress out of receiving drugs for a lot of people. You also won't have to worry about the needle breaking or having a painful bruise form afterwards. Anyone who has to inject themselves regularly will also benefit from no longer breaking their skin with a needle. The other good news is the jet injector can be used to extract fluid as well as deliver it, and due to the rate at which it works, the device can also be used to deliver drugs in powder form. Jet injection is not a new idea, but devices that have gone before lacked fine control. The MIT injector solves that problem, meaning it is more likely to be considered as a replacement for needles. And that article's from geek.com back in 2012, so I don't really know what's happened with that device. I mean, these sorts of things have to be tested and trialed and go through various experimentational phases, so yeah, I think it would be cool to have that one day. I don't personally have a problem with needles, but I don't think I would have the coordination to administer anything to myself that way. So it does seem like a great invention in that sense, but I have to wonder if this will be adopted widely and how long that would take. You know, doctors and nurses more likely just opt for traditional needles because that's what they've used, they're used to it. But the whole thing about the jet spray, there are so many horror stories of high pressure paint guns and water blasters and stuff like that. If it breaks the skin, it's going inside of you, you know, like in a second, it's half a liter of paint or oxygen inside of their body. And well, at least in those two cases that I heard about, those people survived, but it was not pain free. Let's just say it was that they nearly died. So it's fascinating that high pressure technology can also be used for medical purposes rather than just being so devastating and destructive. Alright, that about covers it. This is Colson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.